From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! President Clinton is sworn in for a second term.
Everyone who can work will work. With today's permanent underclass, part of tomorrow's growing middle class.
We'll speak with janitors cleaning up the inaugural mess. They say it takes more than working hard to join the middle class. It takes organizing for decent health care and wages. Also, a look at the record of violence against women's health clinics as a second clinic is bombed in less than a week. And today, House members meet to determine the punishment for one of their own, House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
It seems to me that this circumstance reflects another truth just as serious, and that is that ethics are perhaps most important when the lines are not clear, not when they are, and that ethical people really do not seek to push the envelope as far as it can be pushed, but rather they really don't seek to gain advantage from the uncertainty of blurred lines.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The stage is set for Congress to punish one of its most powerful leaders. The House will vote today on a resolution to reprimand House Speaker Newt Gingrich and assess him a financial penalty of $300,000. Gingrich has admitted ethical wrongdoing in connection with a college course and TV project financed by tax-exempt groups. He also admits giving the Ethics Committee misleading information. Republicans expect rousing and emotional debate today over Gingrich, but they're hoping this will be the end of the long-running ethics case. Democrats are demanding that it would only be proper for Gingrich to pay the $300,000 penalty out of his own pocket instead of using campaign or legal defense funds. His lawyer promises to do what's legal, ethical, and appropriate. A one-day walkout by West Coast longshoremen to support locked-out British dock workers prompted delays at several major ports. Monday's walkout by the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union in San Francisco was aimed at the West Coast's biggest ports, Seattle, Portland, Oakland, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Long Beach. About 50 ships are unloaded each day, industry officials said. Some ships were delayed 12 hours or more because of the walkout, costing owners $3,000 to $4,000 an hour in extra costs. The longshoremen were protesting the treatment of their colleagues in Liverpool, which was the last British port to remain unionized after the government privatized the ports in 1989. In other labor news, South Korean President Kim Jong-sam yesterday conceded that a new labor law had sparked public anxiety and hurt the economy, and he agreed to send it back to Parliament in a stunning concession to the opposition. In a meeting with his chief political rivals, Kim expressed sorrow for output losses of billions of dollars through strikes sparked by forced passage of the controversial bill. Labor strife had defeated the law's aim of revitalizing a sluggish economy, he said. Kim agreed to reopen debate on another controversial law, reviving a once notorious domestic spy agency. And in a further about-face, he told heads of three main political parties he would instruct officials to suspend arrest warrants served on strike leaders, seven of whom are sheltering in Seoul's Myeongdong Cathedral. One of the world's top exporters of landmines, Italy, endorsed a U.S. plan today that urges a step-by-step negotiation for a worldwide ban on the weapons. Italian Foreign Minister Lamberto Dini said his country had taken steps toward imposing a total ban on production of mines and the destruction of stockpiles. Dini told members of the 61-country Conference on Disarmament that it should also ban the production of material used to make nuclear weapons, plutonium, and highly enriched uranium. And the Simon Wiesenthal Center has called for an investigation into claims that former President Juan Perón of Argentina offered Argentine citizenship to about 8,000 fugitive Nazis. In a letter sent to Foreign Minister Guido Di Tella, the center asked the government to look into the allegations made over the weekend by Pedro Bianchi, the lawyer for former SS Captain Erik Priebke. In a telephone interview with the Associated Press yesterday, Bianchi, a legal advisor to the foreign ministry in the late 40s, said 2,000 Nazis took up Perón's offer and settled in Argentina. He said other Nazis accepted the papers but moved on to Paraguay or Bolivia. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Politicians, corporate revelers, lobbyists, and even some regular people party deep into the night and early morning today, celebrating the 53rd presidential inaugural and the start of the second term of President Bill Clinton. The Washington balls followed President Clinton's swearing-in ceremony on the steps of the Capitol yesterday. President Clinton's 22-minute speech, however, did not receive much applause from pundits. The New York Times lampooned it, saying that the speech was no bridge to the history books.
We need a new government for a new century. Humble enough not to try to solve all our problems for us, but strong enough to give us the tools to solve our problems for ourselves. A government that is smaller, lives within its means, and does more with less. Yet where it can stand up for our values and interests around the world, and where it can give Americans the power to make a real difference in their everyday lives, government should do more, not less. The preeminent mission of our new government is to give all Americans an opportunity, not a guarantee, but a real opportunity to build better lives.
It was also the official observance of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday yesterday, a day to remember the civil rights leader who was killed while supporting the garbage workers of Memphis, Tennessee. So we thought we'd spend part of today with the janitors and the people who clean up the nation's capital. Janitors here in Washington, D.C. are paid as little as $5.75 an hour, or $12,000 a year, far below the poverty level. So they did not exactly think it was they that the president was addressing yesterday.
Parents and children will have time not only to work, but to read and play together. And the plans they make at their kitchen table will be those of a better home, a better job, the certain chance to go to college. Our streets will echo again with the laughter of our children because no one will try to shoot them or sell them drugs anymore. Everyone who can work will work, with today's permanent underclass part of tomorrow's growing middle class. New miracles of medicine at last will reach not only those who can claim care now, but the children and hardworking families too long denied.
For many in the permanent underclass, though, they don't see that just working hard is going to take them into the middle class. They see that organizing for better wages and for better health care is the only way that's going to bring their standard of living up. And joining us right now to talk about the situation of the working poor are two people. Blanca Zelaya is a cleaning worker with Local 82 who's been on strike for 4 months here in Washington, D.C. And we're also joined by Maria Naranjo, a senior organizer with Local 82 of the Service Employees International Union, known as the SEIU. Well, Blanca, why don't we begin with you? Can you tell us why you're on strike today?
Estoy de huelga porque ganamos nada más 5.75.
I'm on strike because we only make about 5.75 an hour.
Y eso no nos alcanza. Y estamos en una lucha por ganar 7.50.
And that isn't enough for us. We're in a struggle right now to make 7.50 an hour.
Y por un seguro médico.
And also for health insurance.
Y por beneficios, digamos, vacaciones, días de enfermedad y los feriados.
And we're also here to get some benefits, for example, vacation, sick days, and even holidays that would be paid.
Yo trabajo dos turnos.
I work two different jobs.
Y gano al año $17,000.
And with the two jobs, I make annually about $17,000.
Tengo cinco niños.
I have five children.
Y no alcanza lo que ganamos para cinco niños que tenemos.
And it isn't enough for the five children that I have.
Mis niños se quedan mucho tiempo solos.
My children spend a lot of time at home alone.
Como muchos padres dejan a sus hijos solos.
Because a lot of parents have to leave their children at home alone.
Porque Para tener un solo trabajo no alcanza.
Because to have just one job, it just isn't enough.
Y digamos, para la educación de nuestros hijos,
and for the education of our children,
se necesita que siquiera ganemos $7.50 la hora.
We would at least have to be making $7.50 an hour.
How many hours a day do you work?
So, ¿cuántas horas a la noche trabajas?
Trabajo 12 horas.
I work 12 hours a day.
12 horas. Y mis hijos, digamos, se van a la escuela en la mañana.
And my children, for example, they go to school in the morning.
Cuando regresan en la tarde.
When they come back in the afternoon.
No me encuentran.
They don't find me at home.
Están, digamos, se paga una señora para que los cuide.
I have to pay someone to take care of them.
Entonces, de lo que ganamos, hay que pagar babysitter.
And then everything that I make, I have to pay for a babysitter.
Comprar, digamos, los útiles de la escuela.
You know, buy the things for the utilities and things for the school.
Todo.
Everything.
Entonces, somos explotados en el trabajo.
And a lot of times we're exploited in our workplace.
Maltratados.
Treated badly.
Lo dan demasiado trabajo.
They give us a lot of work.
Y si no lo hacemos, también los despiden del trabajo.
And if we don't do the work, then obviously we're going to be fired, so.
Who are you striking against?
¿En quién estás en contra? ¿En quién estás haciendo la huelga en contra ahorita?
En contra de la huelga es de la PNR.
We're on strike against a company called PNR.
Porque es la más grande que está.
It's one of the largest cleaning companies here.
Entonces ella paga muy barato.
And they pay very cheaply.
Y si ella no quiere unión y ni pagar beneficios, ni un seguro médico, ni pagar los $7.50, no podemos nosotros que los demás paguen esa.
And if this company, for example, doesn't, you know, pay workers $7.50 or give them benefits, then it's going to hurt the rest of us.
Well, let me ask you, Maria Naranjo, a question. You are the senior organizer mm-hmm. with Local 82. And I've been following Justice for Janitors for a long time. I remember, I think it was at the 1988 Democratic National Convention in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Justice for Janitors was out there, and they managed to get ABC or NBC, CBS, one of the networks, out of the Marriott because it wasn't an organized hotel when they were broadcasting from there. And they were protesting all over the city. What is this campaign, Justice for Janitors, that sets it apart from a lot of the other strategies that have come out of the unions in recent years?
Well, Justice for Janitors has been known pretty much as a very militant grassroots campaign. At least in D.C., it started about 10 years ago. We don't use the traditional forms of organizing, which is an election campaign where we have to get a percentage of folks to sign union cards and then we have to go through an election and all that. Basically, what we do is we are street fighters, is what you want to call it. Janitors who are angry, who are upset about the low wages, about the lack of benefits, decide that they want to fight and decide that the only power that they really have is their work. So if they decide that they're going to strike, then they're taking away that their labor from these big cleaning companies here in D.C. or in Los Angeles or Denver. Justice for Janitors is a campaign, a national campaign, not only in Washington, D.C., but as I mentioned, in other parts of the country. We've had success in Los Angeles, where about 90% of the cleaning commercial cleaning janitors are union. In cities like Denver, in New York City, for example, about 90-95% of the janitors, they are union. In D.C. is where we're sort of, having the most difficulty in getting janitors the wages that they deserve.
And who is it mainly that you strike against, these private companies?
It's the private companies. I mean, the way that the cleaning industry is set up anywhere nationally is that janitors are contracted out. It's a very popular, phase that's going in this country. Everything is getting privatized. Everything is getting contracted out. The janitors may clean building X. The owner is the one who pays the cleaning company, but the janitors cannot go on strike or protest against the building owner, even though he's the person who has all the money and the power to make the difference for the janitors. They go and they protest or they go on strike against their cleaning company. And the response that we usually hear from the cleaning companies is, we don't have the money to pay people more. You know, the building owners aren't giving us the money to pay you anymore, so we can't really do anything about it. Our strikes and everything are directly, obviously, against the cleaning company, as legally we have to do it that way.
How successful have you been?
In the last 10 years here in Washington, D.C., when we began to campaign in 1987, I believe, or 88, There was only one building that was union. Now 42% of the commercial cleaning buildings are union.
Let me ask Blanca this question. We just heard a quote from President Clinton yesterday at his inauguration. In his speech, he said, "Parents and children will have time not only to work, but to read and play together, and the plans they make at their kitchen table will be those of a better home, a better job, a certain chance to go to college." Do you see that at all in your future?
No.
No.
5.75 no es dinero.
No, 5.75 is not a just wage.
No, para una familia no es dinero.
No, for a family it is not enough money.
Póngase a pensar cuánto se gasta por cada niño.
Try to think about how much you have to spend for each child.
A mí, por supuesto, digamos, mis niños son muy enfermos.
For example, my children are very sick, are very ill.
Eso no alcanza 5.75 por una hora.
And that doesn't, 5.75 an hour isn't enough.
So how can you risk going out on strike?
So cómo puedes arriesgar salir en huelga?
Are you getting any money now?
¿Estás recibiendo algún dinero ahorita?
No, no estamos recibiendo un dinero nada más que la unión los ayuda.
It's hard because the union is giving us some money right now, a strike fund.
Pero nosotros, todos mis compañeros y yo, hemos decidido a salir a huelga porque ya los cansamos de ser explotados y maltratados.
But myself and my other co-workers decided to go on strike because we're just tired of being exploited and being treated badly.
Y no tener nada de beneficio.
And not to have any benefits.
Y pagamos un tax.
And we also pay taxes.
Let me read you the second part of President Clinton's quote. He says, "Everyone who can work will work, with today's permanent poor part of tomorrow's growing middle class." What do you think would bring you into the middle class? We're talking to Blanca Zelaya, who is one of the cleaning workers here in D.C.
Se necesita, digamos, que los sueldos los suban para arriba.
They need the wages to go higher.
Eso se le pide a Clinton, que suban los sueldos, no 5.75, por lo menos 7.50.
And that's what, you know, I would like to ask Clinton, you know, to help us in this, not 5.75, but 7.50 an hour.
Maria Naranjo, let me ask you, does workfare and the whole attack on welfare have any effect on these workers around Washington, D.C., workers like Blanca?
In terms of the welfare and any other the changes that are happening here, most of our workers, at least the workers I've come across, are not on welfare or do not apply for certain assistance because, as Blanca would say, they have two or three jobs. These are hardworking people. These are people who have children not only in this country but in their countries like El Salvador or Guatemala. They're making ends meet. They're not with their children at home. I think it is very interesting, for example, the quote that you read about President Clinton about spending time with the family and at around the kitchen table. It makes me think a little bit, just knowing I visit a lot of these workers at home, usually on the weekend, because during the week you cannot find janitorial workers at home. They work, for example, Blanca works at an overnight building. I believe she gets in at 10:30 at night. She gets out at 6 in the morning. She probably comes home and sees her children then, and then she goes back to her part-time job, which is a 6 to 10 job at night. So it is very interesting to think that while President Clinton is saying that we need to be responsible, we need to, you know, we can get ourselves out of the lower classes and get into the middle class, that is true. People like Blanca Zelaya are trying to do that. But for some reason, it's not working. And it's not working because the wages aren't as high as they should be.
Well, I can say, living right here next to the studios in WPFW here in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., this whole area is an area where Salvadorans live.
Yes.
And when I wake up around 5 in the morning, I'm woken up by all the people around me who are getting up for work.
Exactly.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, Blanca Zelaya, who is with Local 82 on strike for 4 months, and Maria Naranjo, senior organizer with Local 82 of the Service Employees International Union. Do you have a phone number where people can call if they want to get involved with the whole Justice for Janitors Organizing Committee? Because I know it's not only janitors who are involved with this, but also people who simply support their efforts.
Yes. We have a lot of support from the community. Our number is area code 202-789-8282, and they can ask to speak with me, Maria Naranjo.
That's 202-789-8282. Thank you very much
for being with
us. I also just wanted to comment that as the inaugural was going on yesterday, my producer, Dan Coughlin, and I went over to the counter-inaugural. Well, it was over, and that was over at D and 2nd Street here in Washington, D.C., at the Creative Communities for Nonviolence, which is a shelter of about 1,500 people. And we spoke to people there about what promise they see. But what they see every day is the shelter simply getting more and more crowded, with beds not available now for at least 3 weeks. And I was looking at the Wall Street Journal today, and there was an interesting little squib on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. They have a section called Work Week, a special news report about life on the job and trends taking shape there. And it says, Wisconsin penalties trim welfare rolls, but boost calls for emergency help. The state, a pioneer in welfare reform, last March began reducing the checks of recipients who didn't work or search for work for 35 hours each week. Those who don't complete at least one-fourth of the work requirement lose their entire check for the month. Some folks are not convinced we mean business, said David Blaska, a state spokesman. Last November, 1,300 recipients received no welfare money. An additional 2,500 got only partial payments. Meanwhile, the number of people seeking emergency shelter through the Milwaukee Salvation Army skyrocketed. 2,400 people stayed in shelters in 1996, up from 1,500 in 1995. And you're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Bombings against women's health clinics that provide abortion in Atlanta and Tulsa, Oklahoma this past week have once again highlighted the ongoing nationwide attacks on abortion providers. In Atlanta this past Thursday, two bombs exploded outside a building housing a women's health clinic, injuring 6 people. In Tulsa on Sunday, a blast rocked a clinic that had already been bombed on New Year's Day. Joining us today to discuss the recent attacks and the potential for more trouble in this run-up to tomorrow's Roe versus Wade anniversary, I guess it's the 24th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, is Vicky Saporta, and she's executive director of the National Abortion Federation, which is a professional association of abortion providers. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, tell us first about what you know about these series of bombings, the two bombings in Atlanta, the two bombings in Tulsa.
Not much more than what has been reported in the news media. Both clinics were bombed within the past week. And
what are these clinics? Who runs them?
They're both women's reproductive health care clinics that do a wide range of reproductive health care services, including abortion.
And why do you think Atlanta and Tulsa were hit? I should say that in the Atlanta case, the police have put out a slight doubt, saying it's possible that there was another office in the building that was targeted. Maybe they're confusing it with the women's health clinic. But now with the Tulsa bombings and with this, the fact that we're coming up on the 24th anniversary tomorrow, Roe versus Wade, it sort of looks more likely that it was a target of the clinic.
In Atlanta, the one bomb was planted in the ceiling of the clinic. And in Tulsa, it was the second time that clinic has been bombed within a month. So we're pretty certain that it, in fact, was related to anti-abortion violence. The National Abortion Federation has been collecting statistics on violence against abortion providers for more than 20 years. And initially, the violence peaked in 1985, only to see a decline in the late 80s, and the violence skyrocketed again in 1992 and 1993, which led to the passage of the FACE law. And FACE, it makes it a federal crime for anyone to use force, the threat of force, or physical obstruction to interfere with the provision of reproductive health care services. And that law was needed, and it was demonstrated dramatically in 1994 when we had four murders, two receptionists, one doctor, and one clinic escort. And so there has been a pattern of violence against abortion providers for 20 years. And we have an extreme group who's in a minority, who takes the law into their own hands and commits these heinous crimes.
Now, it looks like even FACE is under judicial attack with a recent ruling in New York by a judge that people who were blockading a clinic there had a religious right to do so. Can you explain that decision?
We have had FACE challenged over a dozen times since its passage, and in every instance, it has been declared to be constitutional. It does not prohibit peaceful picketing, and I wish the pickets at these clinics and the demonstrations were peaceful, but all too often they are not. And since the passage of FACE, we've actually had more instances of picketing and people exercising their First Amendment rights. FACE is constitutional. It has led to a decrease in the violence against abortion providers, and what needs to be done is it needs to be uniformly and aggressively enforced throughout the country. Under FACE, you can have both criminal and civil penalties for violating the law, and more criminal prosecutions need to take place under this law so that the people who are perpetrating these acts of violence are put behind bars.
Now, I assume that the New York decision is going to be appealed, but could that challenge FACE, I mean, ultimately?
It is certainly positioned to do so, but we believe that FACE will continue to be upheld as constitutional.
Now, ironically, just last week when news of the Atlanta bombings happened, you were in the midst of a news conference about the record of violence targeted at women's health clinics. I think people will be surprised to realize how many people have been targeted working at these clinics over the last few years. The only time we hear about it is when there's a bombing. Can you talk a little about the doctors, the healthcare providers that have actually been attacked?
Over a period of 20 years, there has been all types of violence and disruption. The worst, of course, being the five murders that have taken place. But just last month, there was an attempted murder of a Louisiana doctor who was asked if he was the doctor when he was entering the clinic, and when he replied that he was nearly stabbed to death and is in very serious condition. And that person went to another clinic 80 miles away and was waiting for the doctor there. So we have had many attempted murders as well. This bombing is one in a series of bombings that has taken place. There have been also attempted bombings. There have been a series of arsons. In the past year in Spokane and Oklahoma, we've had two bombings. There has been a series of arsons that has taken place across the country, stalking and death threats. And no abortion provider, whether they're a doctor, a nurse, administrator, or any other healthcare professional, should have to put their lives on the line to provide reproductive healthcare services to women. And unfortunately, that's what's taking place all across this country. And women shouldn't have to walk the gauntlet of violence and disruption in order to obtain reproductive healthcare services. This violence is totally unacceptable, and we're calling on citizens and communities around the country to support their providers and let it be known to their law enforcement officials and others that this type of violence is not welcome and will not be tolerated in their communities.
We're talking to Vicki Saporta. She is executive director of the National Abortion Federation, a professional association of abortion providers. Now, you represent these abortion providers. What kind of effect do these threats have on them? For example, in this country, how many states or portions of states don't have abortion available, despite the fact that it's legal? So in a sense, it's de facto illegal for people because they can't get it as a result of doctors simply being afraid.
Access is a very big problem. And 84% of the counties in the United States have no abortion provider.
What percent?
84% of counties. And if you go to rural counties, that number jumps to 92%. And so access is a huge problem. Part of it has been the violence and disruption. I mean, people put not only their own lives at risk, but their families' lives at risk sometimes. And so we have had a number of providers who, in fact, have decided that they could no longer put up with the violence and harassment. But we have others who have entered and have decided to provide abortions because others have been leaving and because they abhor the violence. And we've had a series of our providers call the office within the past week saying they're ever more committed to providing abortion services and they will not be intimidated out of practice.
What about training in medical schools? How available is it?
That has been a huge problem, and actually the National Abortion Federation has a whole access initiative project that deals with these issues. And the ACGME last year decided that all
ACGME,
the Graduate Council on
Medical Education,
decided that they were going to require all OBGYN programs in the country to teach abortion, and then Congress moved to nullify those enforcement procedures because only about 12% currently teach abortion. And when you consider that it is the most common OBGYN surgery, it is unconscionable that doctors could graduate from medical school as OBGYNs and not know or understand how to perform an abortion because they may have to do it in an emergency situation. And that's not to say that they have to go out and provide them or specialize them in them or anything else, but they need to have an understanding.
Are there medical schools that used to provide them that kind of training and now have stopped?
There have been some that have no longer offered the training. We think that many more, because of this decision by the ACGME, will in fact offer the training, even though Congress has taken away the enforcement procedures.
What about RU486, if it ever is widely available here? First of all, what's the controversy over it right now in this country and in disseminating it? And then will it make abortion, the surgical procedure, obsolete?
Medical abortion or abortion done by a combination of pharmaceuticals takes place within the first 49 days of pregnancy. And so it will never replace surgical abortion. It's another option for women. Sometimes women would prefer a surgical abortion when they have the options described to them. But it is an option. It's a choice. Right now, we have over 60 sites that offer medical abortion using methotrexate and misoprostol, which are a combination of drugs that work. Mifepristone, or RU486, is currently before the FDA. They have initially given a letter of approval, and now we're waiting on the marketing and the pills.
What's
and how
the controversy over it right now?
Distributed. Right now, it's a matter of being able to show the FDA how they would put it on the market. And it is available throughout Europe. Over 200,000 women have safely used RU486 to terminate an unwanted pregnancy, and it should be an option for American women. It is safe, it's effective, and offers them a choice for very early pregnancy termination.
Mm-hmm. What about the whole issue of late-term abortion? It was very hot a few months ago. President Clinton, in the end, vetoed the ban on late-term abortion, what the opponents call partial birth abortion. But I've heard that President Clinton might sign a late-term abortion bill if it met the requirements that he wants, which is to preserve the life and health of the mother.
The National Abortion Federation is actually the organization that brought forward the women who have found out late in very wanted pregnancies that they were carrying babies that couldn't survive outside their wombs. And in order for President Clinton to sign any bill, he has said it needed to protect the life and health of the women. But the problem is that the opposition is so extreme in their opposition that they don't want to even protect the health of women and their future fertility. And so I think it's going to be very difficult to reach any kind of compromise, because I do not believe the other side will compromise. And it's very important that women who find out that they're carrying babies that can't survive outside their wombs, and that those pregnancies may also compromise their own health, are able to have appropriate medical treatment. And Congress should not be the ones who are deciding what type of medical procedures are appropriate and what type are not. This belongs within the medical community, and decisions about whether to terminate and how to terminate a woman's pregnancy belong between the women, her family, and her doctor, not her member of Congress.
Have you evaluated the current Congress? Some of the fiercest opponents of abortion, like Bob Dorn in California, was defeated. And then you have Woody Jenkins, who was defeated by Mary Landrieu by just a hair in Louisiana for Senate. And he was a fierce anti-abortion activist.
We gained some House seats during the last election, but both houses of Congress are still anti-choice. And what most Americans don't realize is that there were 54 votes in the 104th Congress on reproductive rights, and the choice community won only four of those. So it was a very bad year for reproductive choice on a federal level, whether it had to do with funding or abortions on military bases or for federal employees, and whether it was covered under their insurance coverage. There were a lot of things that came up, and they've been coming up on a state level as well. There was an unprecedented number of state legislative bills introduced to restrict women's right to choose in one form or another.
At this point, in how many states is federal funding for abortion banned, which means that basically, for all intents and purposes, poor women can't get abortions? In how many states is that the case?
I'm not sure of the exact number, but more states ban federal funding than accept it.
Mm-hmm. And with this whole push to, devolution to the states, overall, that has a very negative effect on women's access to abortion?
We believe that it probably will, yes.
Well, back to the issue of the women's health clinic bombings, where we started. You're talking about Oklahoma a few times. You're talking about it with this bombing that happened in the, that happened just in the last few days, and a bombing on New Year's Day. It's interesting, Oklahoma, because, of course, when we think of Oklahoma, we think of Oklahoma City, the federal building being bombed. Do you see any connections? I don't mean by the person who did it, but ideology-wise?
Yes, I think the same people who would bomb a federal building, who would burn down black churches, are the same people who would bomb and burn abortion clinics. And this type of violence cannot be tolerated, and law enforcement really does need to very aggressively find the perpetrators of these heinous crimes.
What is the connection between the militia movement and anti-abortion activism?
There have been several studies that have been done that show some connections between people who are active in both movements.
Mm-hmm. And so is there any work being done to track the right wing and the growth of militia movements? I know Planned Parenthood used to have a division that just did that, tracking of the right, but they dissolved a lot of it.
Planned Parenthood still does research in this area, as do other groups, and you will have here in Washington tonight the who's who of the extreme anti-choice movement all having dinner together. They do it every year during this week, and they actually celebrate the crimes that have been committed. They read letters from convicted murderer Paul Hill and convicted bomber.
Paul Hill killed David Gunn in.
Killed. The escort and the doctor did a double murder in 1994.
In Pensacola, Florida?
Britton and Barrett, yes. And they will read letters from convicted bomber and arsonist Shelley Shannon, And they encourage their supporters to go out and commit other acts of violence. The people who organize this banquet have already been in the media celebrating the bombing in Atlanta. And this truly cannot be tolerated.
We have to wrap up, but a quick question on Newt Gingrich. How determined is he right now? Today we're going to see him in some way sanctioned. It's expected that there will be a vote for him to be reprimanded and to get a $300,000 fine for his activities. And some Democrats are happy that he'll remain Speaker because he'll be more contrite, they feel. What effect do you think that will have around the issue of abortion? The first 100 days of the 104th Congress, they were talking about the issue of abortion every day, I would say, almost in Congress when I was covering it.
The majority of Americans are pro-choice, and I don't think they want Congress to be continually talking about abortion in the next 100 days. There are critical issues that this Congress needs to address that are facing the nation, and that's where they should concentrate their efforts.
Vicki Support, I want to thank you for joining us. If people want to get in touch with your organization, the National Abortion Federation, where can they reach you? By phone, the web?
We have a website. Our telephone number is 202-667-5881.
202-667-5881. And the website?
I don't have that address off the top of my head, but we are on the web. We also operate a toll-free number, 1-800-772-9100. If you're a woman who needs information about abortion and wants to be referred to a quality provider, we provide that service.
Give that
toll
free number out again.
1-800-772-9100.
Well, Vicki Saporta, Executive Director of the National Abortion Federation, thank you very much for joining us on this eve of the 24th anniversary of Roe versus Wade.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Later today, the House of Representatives is due to formally reprimand and fine the Speaker of the House, Georgia Republican Newt Gingrich. At least that is the recommendation of the House Ethics Committee that held a much-shortened public hearing last Friday.
I would like to announce that the committee has adopted the report of the subcommittee, and the committee has agreed by a vote of 7-1 to recommend to the House that Representative Gingrich be reprimanded and that he pay costs in the amount of $300,000. This is a tough penalty. I believe it's an appropriate penalty. It demonstrates that no one is above the rule.
Again, that was Chair Nancy Johnson. She's the Republican chair of the House Ethics Committee. She is the Republican from Connecticut who almost lost her race because of her conduct around the whole Ethics Committee investigation into Newt Gingrich over the last 2 years. And she announced that the vote was 7-1, the House Ethics Committee recommending to the full House to vote for a reprimand, which is not the harshest sanction that Newt Gingrich could have received. He could have been censured, which would have meant he would have had to give up the House speakership, or he could have been expelled from the House. But there were also lesser sanctions, and those sanctions included a letter of reproval, which the committee decided not to give the Speaker. Well, the hearings that did take place were sharply criticized. The Republican leadership drastically shortened the hearings from 5 days to one, and then they tried to bury the hearings on Friday afternoon of inaugural weekend. Still, again, the committee did vote. They voted about 9:30 on Friday night, Eastern Standard Time. And today we're going to bring you some more highlights of those hearings on Friday, because we at Pacifica felt it was important not to bury these hearings and to give you an opportunity to hear what the Republicans and Democrats on the committee had to say. Yesterday we brought you some of what Special Counsel James M. Cole, the man who investigated Newt Gingrich for the last year, some of his findings. He is a longtime Republican. And today we're going to bring you some of the reaction of some of the House Ethics Committee members. We're going to begin with Lamar Smith. Lamar Smith is a Texas Republican known for his fierce anti-immigrant stance, and he is the newest member of the House Ethics Committee. In fact, he came on in just the last few weeks, and he is one of the fiercest defenders of Newt Gingrich at those hearings that took place on Friday night. And before we go to him, I just wanted to share with you some of James Cole's report, where he talked about what Newt Gingrich, the Speaker of the House, was trying to do, much of it quoting Newt Gingrich and his documents that were submitted to the House Ethics Committee. Yesterday, we laid out for you the superstructure that Newt Gingrich had laid out to support his fundraising activities and to support the Republican Revolution and bringing Republicans to the House. This is page 39 of the Special Counsel James Cole's report. He said the movement was to develop a message and then disseminate and teach that message. One of the important aspects of the movement was the creation of, quote, disseminating groups and a system of communication and education. It also sought to professionalize the House Republicans by using the message to attract voters, resources, and candidates, and develop a mechanism for winning seats. The ultimate goal of the movement was to replace the welfare state with an opportunity society, and all efforts had to be exclusively directed to that goal. Ultimately, it was envisioned that a Republican majority would be the heart of the American movement. Mr. Gingrich's role in this movement was to be the advocate of civilization, the definer of civilization, the teacher of the rules of civilization, the arouser of those who form civilization, the organizer of the pro-civilization activists, and the leader, possibly, of the civilizing forces. And all of those are in quotes coming from the Republican documents themselves. The report goes on to say, in doing this, Gingrich intended to retain a primary focus on elected political power as the central arena and fulcrum by which a free people debate their future and govern themselves. The support systems for this movement included GOPAC, some Republican international organizations, and possibly a foundation. There was substantial discussion of how to disseminate the message of the movement. Some of the methods discussed for this dissemination included, quote, possibly a series of courses with audio and videotape follow-ons, possibly a textbook series, campus intellectual appearances on the histories, and it goes on from there. And this is what the intent of this superstructure of college courses and foundations that Newt Gingrich set up to fund the Republican Revolution. And so now we're going to go to Lamar Smith, one who supports Newt Gingrich very much. And in fact, in that 7-1 vote, voting for a reprimand and for the $300,000 penalty for Newt Gingrich, Lamar Smith was the dissenting vote. He was the 7-1. And this is what he had to say in his summation at the House Ethics Committee hearings late on Friday night.
The case before us, though, goes beyond a single individual, and it goes beyond a single report. It also encompasses the faith of the American people in their elected representatives, and in fact, their faith in the government itself. To retain and strengthen that confidence, we need to act, in my judgment, not on the basis of animosity or personal friendship, but on the basis of established principles. And recognizing the right of anyone to disagree, I'd like to suggest what these principles are. First of all, the penalty should fit the wrongdoing. It should not be out of proportion to the wrong committed. And some questions I think that we might ask ourselves tonight is, how does the admitted wrong compare to other transgressions? Was there obstruction of justice? Was there harm to others? Was there perjury? Was there personal financial gain? Was a federal law broken? Perhaps we should also consider the embarrassment, the public criticism, even the personal abuse to which the respondent has been subjected. And I don't suggest that because he has suffered much, we ought to be pardoning him. But what I do suggest is I think that the sanctions should be tempered by the penalties already endured. The second principle is engraved on the front of the Supreme Court building about three blocks from where we sit. It reads, and I know everyone is familiar with it, equal justice under law. That simply means no double standard. Members of Congress ought to receive similar penalties for similar infractions of federal laws or of House rules. The volcano of partisanship should be quenched when we consider imposing sanctions. A third principle involves the understandable tradition of following precedent. If laws and rules are going to be respected, it is essential that they be enforced in a consistent and predictable way. So precedents, at least to me, are instructive and, I think, usually persuasive. According to Ethics Committee rules, a number of sanctions can be considered, including expulsion, censure, reprimand, and fine. Other actions that the committee could take include issuing a letter of reproval or dismissing the case itself. Since the penalty of reprimand has been recommended, we should consider the precedents for that penalty. Of particular interest, as I mentioned a while ago, are the cases involving former Representatives Edward Roybal and Charles Wilson. The committee found that those members had knowingly made false statements. In each case, the final sanction levied was a reprimand. There appears to be no precedent for a reprimand or more severe penalty for a member of Congress who has not been found to have knowingly made a false statement to the committee. In fact, the precedents are all to the contrary. Where there has been no finding of intent to mislead, as is the situation here, the committee either has dismissed the case or has issued a letter of reproval. In determining what sanction to apply, the committee should rightly consider aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And no doubt all the aggravating circumstances have already been brought out tonight. So let me place on the scales some of the mitigating factors. Perhaps most importantly, there has been no finding that a tax law or any law has been broken. Rather, an infraction of a House rule has been determined. And this is significant. The respondent is a political entrepreneur, and like a business entrepreneur, he is willing to take risk. He has, in his own words, gone up to the line that distinguishes lawful from unlawful actions, but there is no finding that he actually crossed it. And anyone who drives, as I mentioned a while ago, knows that you couldn't and shouldn't be ticketed for running a yellow light, no matter how close you come, it comes to becoming a red light.
You're listening to Congressmember Lamar Smith of Texas. He was the only one to vote against the recommended sanction of the House Ethics Committee, which is reprimand and a $300,000 fine of the House Speaker. He was followed by Congressmember Tom Sawyer of Ohio, a sixth-term Democrat. Sawyer's interesting in that he looked vulnerable in last year's election, and Gingrich even campaigned for his opponent late in the race. And he just had this to say.
I really admire what Mrs. Pelosi said about ethics not being something we do when we're not busy. It's really the standard by which we conduct ourselves in our lives and certainly in our public lives. It seems to me that this circumstance reflects another truth just as serious, and that is that ethics are perhaps most important when the lines are not clear, not when they are. And that ethical people really do not seek to push the envelope as far as it can be pushed, but rather they really don't seek to gain advantage from the uncertainty of blurred lines. If those of us who have been struggling through this come out of this with a clearer view of that, if all of us who serve in a place like this understand that, perhaps some real benefit will have been gained.
That's Democratic Congressmember Tom Sawyer. He and Congressmember Nancy Pelosi, also Democrat, she's from California, together they really took issue with the Republicans who said, particularly Lamar Smith, and the attorneys for Newt Gingrich, who said that Newt Gingrich was a very busy man, and it's that they really objected to, that you can't be busy and ethical at the same time. Well, I got a chance to speak to Nancy Pelosi over the weekend. She was at an Emily's List luncheon celebrating the inauguration of President Clinton. Emily's List is the Democratic group that gives money to women pro-choice Democratic candidates around the country. They were celebrating the victories and the number of women that they had elected. And afterwards, I went up on the stage where Nancy Pelosi was standing with the other women and asked her just to comment on these hearings and what is going to be happening today.
Well, I'm very pleased with the bipartisan recommendation that we have made. It's very tough. It's a reprimand plus. $300,000 speaks very eloquently to the seriousness of the violations that Newt Gingrich committed, which he admitted to, and which brought discredit to the House of Representatives.
Are there more charges that are being considered against him now?
Well, there are other charges against him. Whether the Congress decides to take them up or not is another issue. But I think that this bipartisan recommendation is a very serious embarrassment to Newt Gingrich. It's hard to see how the Republican caucus would want to keep him in as Speaker, but that is their choice. I think that right now it'll be interesting for people to read the report, because it's not only about the violations, it's also about the person, and they will learn a lot about Newt Gingrich and what he was planning. And I think it'll be very interesting to the public.
Do you think Nancy Johnson broke the rules by canceling the hearings that were supposed to be in actually a week ago?
Yes, Nancy Johnson broke the rules. We had agreed on a certain procedure. They say the people who are in charge can make the rules. I don't necessarily agree with that, but they certainly are not entitled to break the rules. And that's what Nancy Johnson did. I don't think we've seen the end of that, because we cannot live in a Congress where there is no respect for the rules, a disregard for rulings of the parliamentarian. That is borders on anarchy.
What was the ruling of the parliamentarian?
The parliamentarian ruled that she could not unilaterally cancel the hearings, and she did. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So sweet. Thank you.
So you cannot unilaterally break the rules. And the parliamentarian ruled and informed her and informed us that it was not allowed for her to cancel the hearings. Nonetheless, she took it upon herself to do so. This is outrageous.
What would have happened if the hearings had been at least 5 days differently?
If we had had the hearing, it would have enabled the public to hear the case against Newt Gingrich laid out by the special counsel. As it was, he had about an hour to summarize his report, which is much different than a prosecutor laying out the story the charges against Newt Gingrich and the violations which Gingrich had admitted to. So there would have been a clearer picture. They may not have lasted 5 days, because the comments of the members, once the counsel had taken the full time to lay out his story, the comments by the members may have just been 1 day. It could have probably been done in 3 or 4 days. But it certainly shouldn't have been started at 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon on inaugural weekend, where most people are now not paying attention. It's one thing to say to people, read a couple hundred page report. It's another thing to have the counsel very clearly and carefully lay out the case before them. They did not want the public to know the facts. That is clear. The facts are embarrassing to Newt Gingrich. They once again wanted to protect him. This is outrageous. But still in all, we were able to come up with a bipartisan agreement for serious violation of House rules, which he admitted bringing discredit to the House of Representatives, with a stiff penalty, as I say, in language the public understands, $300,000.
Randy Evans. And that is California Democratic Congressmember Nancy Pelosi. She served on the House Ethics Committee, and she also served on the House Ethics Subcommittee that actually did the investigation. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we go out with this information about what's going to be happening today in the House. For the first time in its history, the House of Representatives is expected to vote this afternoon to reprimand and fine its Speaker for bringing discredit on the House. Under the House rules, Speaker Newt Gingrich does not need to be present, but he may appear and even speak afterwards to show contrition. And according to the New York Times, the panel concluded, that's the House Ethics Panel, that Newt Gingrich had brought discredit on the House in 3 instances. 2 involved failing to take proper care and seek legal advice about using tax-exempt foundation money for political ends, a televised course in one case, televised town meetings in another. And the 3rd involves supplying the committee with untrue information. We'll bring you excerpts of today's debate on the floor tomorrow on Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Our executive producer, Julie Drizin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!